Chapter 8. Hall of Records. Denisova Cave has had its modern name only since the early 19th century, when a monk, Dionysij Denis, lived, meditated, and left his graffiti here. Before that, the peoples of the Altai used to call it Ajutash, which means bare rock. We have no idea how far that nomenclature may go back. It is certain, however, that Denisova Cave has been used and occupied by various species of human for at least 280,000 years, making it an unrivaled archive, a sort of hall of records of our largely unremembered ancestral story. Since excavations began in 1977, it has proved to be a gift that just keeps on giving, as archaeologists have systematically combed out the secrets buried in its successive occupation levels. At the risk of stating the obvious, in an archaeological excavation, through orderly and undisturbed stratigraphy of the kind that Denisova Cave generally exhibits, the upper levels are the youngest, and the lower levels get progressively older the deeper down you dig. This, for example, is why archaeologists divide the period they call the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age, dating from roughly 3 million years ago until 12,000 years ago, into the Lower, Middle, and Upper Paleolithic, with the latter conventionally dated between 50,000 and 12,000 years ago. The first two trenches at Denisova Cave, both 4 meters deep, sliced down through the more recent levels and exposed artifacts beneath them, dating back to the Upper Paleolithic. In the decades that followed, these deposits proved to be rich, various, and well-preserved, and the cave became recognized as a prehistoric locality of great importance. At certain times during the past 280,000 years, not continuously but at intervals, it had been occupied by Neanderthals, our extinct cousins with whom, as is now widely known, our ancestors interbred and from whom some extant modern human populations have inherited as much as 1 to 4% of their DNA. Neanderthals were probably still using the cave 50,000 years ago. It wasn't until 2010, however, when proof emerged that a human species hitherto unrecognized by science had been present at Denisova, a species now also known to have interbred with our ancestors, that the true global significance of this very obscure and remote place could begin to be fully realized. The sensational news was broken first in the pages of Nature in December 2010 in a benchmark paper, Genetic History of an Archaic Hominin Group from Denisova Cave in Siberia. Co-authored by a stellar team of biomolecular engineers, geneticists, and biologists, with a couple of anthropologists and archaeologists thrown in for good measure, the paper announced the discovery of the distal manual phalanx, in other words, the fingertip, of a juvenile hominin. The phalanx was found in layer 11, which had been dated to 50,000 to 30,000 years ago. This layer contains microblades and body ornaments of polished stone, typical of the Upper Paleolithic industry, generally thought to be associated with modern humans. The big surprise, however, following a thorough analysis of DNA from the fingertip, was that it didn't belong to an anatomically modern human, nor a Neanderthal, but to a species that had diverged from the common lineage leading to anatomically modern humans and Neanderthals about 1 million years ago. This previously unknown species was judged to be a sister group to Neanderthals. Paleo CSI. DNA was on my mind as we scrambled up to the cave, because a good way to get to grips with the challenge of Denisova is to think of it as a crime scene, a very old, neglected, contaminated, and long unrecognized crime scene, from which the physical evidence is mostly gone, apart from a few bones and teeth, but where just enough genetic material might remain to help us figure out what happened here. Nonetheless, from the moment I entered the cave, it impressed itself upon me first, foremost, and forcefully as a sacred and mystical space. It faced roughly west, overlooking the steep slope leading down to the Anui River, and that morning, as no doubt on many mornings over many thousands of years, the brightness of the day outside was reflected back through the entrance to illuminate the spacious main gallery within. Looking up, I saw that a narrow, natural window opened in the ceiling 10 meters above the gallery's west side, close to the entrance, admitting more light, but also, no doubt in ancient times, serving as a chimney. I paused to breathe in the cave air, cool and moist, and to look around, struck by the way the bone-white walls, stained by lichen and covered in the ugly scrawl of recent graffiti that defaced almost every exposed surface, nonetheless gathered about themselves a kind of somber, ancient magnificence. The effect was enhanced by soaring archways leading into the smaller, more intimate east and south galleries, the side chapels to this prehistoric basilica. I deploy the analogy deliberately, because the Denisova cave system does have a cathedral-like feel about it, but I do not claim that it was ever used for religious or spiritual purposes. It may have been, but what the mass of archaeological evidence suggests is that for extraordinarily long periods of time, it functioned as a factory or workshop, and that raw materials were brought here from far-off places to be worked and fashioned. This became clear during the brief visit we made to the Museum of the Peoples of Siberia in Novosibirsk before setting out for Denisova Cave. Director Irina Salnikova apologized that there was so little for us to see in the Denisova room of her museum, explaining that much of the collection was away at exhibitions or in laboratories for further investigation. What she was able to show us, however, as well as many stone tools at various stages of refinement from extremely primitive to sophisticated, were some unusual and beautiful pieces of jewelry, including pendants featuring biconical drilled-out holes, cylindrical beads, a ring carved from marble, a ring carved from mammoth ivory, and bone tubes, perhaps designed to hold bone needles so they could be carried safely. Many of the materials employed had been brought considerable distances to the cave. And now that I reached the cave itself, I could see all three of the galleries in which they'd been found, and inspect the open excavation trenches with little tacks and tags left in place to mark the various occupation levels. It was the gaping rectangular trench in the center of the main gallery, however, I would guess it was 5 meters deep, 4 meters long, and 3 meters wide, that most clearly displayed Denisova's amazing time machine of stratification, with distinct Ice Age occupation levels numbered from 9, the youngest, all the way down to 20, the oldest, right at the bottom. The excavation had descended further here, down to level 22, but the tacks and tags for these last two lower and older levels, visible on early reports of the progress of archaeology in the cave, were no longer present. According to studies undertaken by the excavators, man-made tools and artifacts were found in these two exceedingly ancient lairs, dated by radiothermoluminescence to between 155,000 and 282,000 years ago. The lithic stone industries recovered from strata 22 and 21 are characterized by Levallois and parallel strategies of stone reduction. The toolkit is dominated by side scrapers and notched denticulate tools. I knew that artifacts, together with Neanderthal and Denisovan remains, had been recovered in the excavations in all three galleries across multiple Paleolithic occupation levels. That morning, however, my focus was particularly on level 11 in the East Gallery, where certain unusual and distinctive tools and pieces of jewelry had been found. Some of these had archaeologists scratching their heads. Usual things and unusual things. Annoyingly, I'd been unable to view these special items during my visit to the Museum of the Peoples of Siberia. But I knew from my research that they'd been retrieved, together with other more normal and usual objects, from an almost exclusively Denisovan occupation level of the East Gallery, nominated level 11 by the archaeologists, and dated to the Upper Paleolithic between 29,200 and 48,650 years ago. After the first Neanderthal skeletal remains were identified in Europe in the 19th century, it was, for a very long while, one of the fundamental, unquestioned assumptions of archaeology, a matter taken to be self-evidently true, that other, older, less evolved human species never attained or even in their wildest dreams could hope to aspire to the same levels of cultural development as Homo sapiens. During more than a century of subsequent analysis, and despite multiple additional discoveries, the Neanderthals continued to be depicted as nothing more than brutal, shambling, stupid subhumans, literally morons by comparison with ourselves. Since the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century, however, and with increasing certainty as the evidence has become overwhelming, a new image of the Neanderthals as sensitive, intelligent, symbolic, and creative beings capable of advanced thought processes and technological innovations has taken root amongst archaeologists and is set to become the ruling paradigm. There should be no objection in principle, therefore, to the notion that the anatomically archaic Denisovans, a close genetic sister species to the Neanderthals, might have been capable of creating the sorts of tools and symbolic artifacts that a few decades ago would automatically have been assumed to be the work of anatomically modern humans. Yet, a difficulty arises. Among the more unusual and unique items, excavated from the Paleolithic deposits within the entrance zone of the East Gallery, specifically from level 11.1, were two broken pieces of a dark green chloritolite bracelet. It would have measured 27 millimeters wide and 9 millimeters thick when intact, with an original complete diameter of about 70 millimeters. A detailed use-wear analysis of the bracelet was undertaken and revealed something odd. This artifact was manufactured with the help of various technical methods of stoneworking, including those that are considered non-typical for the Paleolithic period. The bracelet demonstrates a high level of technological skills. In their detailed scientific analysis published in the journal Archaeology, Ethnology and Anthropology of Eurasia, A.P. Derevyanko, M.V. Shunkov and P.V. Volkov draw our attention in particular to a hole drilled close to one of the edges of the bracelet and report that drilling was carried out with a stable drill over the course of at least three stages. Judging by traces on the surface, the speed of drill running was considerable. Vibrations of the rotation axis of the drill are minor, and the drill made multiple rotations around its axis. They therefore conclude that the bracelet constitutes unique evidence of an unexpectedly early employment of two-sided, fast, stationary drilling during the early Upper Paleolithic. This is a big deal. What the investigators are getting at is how peculiar and misplaced in time the bracelet seems to be. It is not simply that it shows the application of skills and technologies that are unique for the Paleolithic. In other words, to state the matter plainly, skills and technologies that had never before been seen in a Paleolithic context in any excavation. But also that at least some of these skills and technologies, like stationary drilling, with the use of a bow drill that does not leave signs of drill vibration, would not be seen again until the Neolithic, many thousands of years later. The bracelet thus refutes what the authors describe as a common assumption held by archaeologists, that stone drilling originated during the Upper Paleolithic, but gained the features of a well-developed technology only during the Neolithic. So not only was this curious bracelet unequivocally the work of anatomically archaic human beings, the Denisovans, but also it testified to their mastery of advanced manufacturing techniques in the Upper Paleolithic, many millennia ahead of the earliest use of these techniques in the Neolithic by our own supposedly advanced species, Homo sapiens. Also made crystal clear was the realization that the Denisovans must have possessed the same kinds of artistic sensibility and self-awareness that we habitually associate only with our own kind. For there can be no doubt that very real, conscious, aware, and unmistakably human beings had interacted with this bracelet at every stage of its conception, design, and manufacture, all the way through to its end use. Though the outward structure of Denisovan skulls might have been rather different from ours, predictable for a sister species to the Neanderthals, the sense of style, design, and personal adornment manifested in the bracelet seems completely modern, and archaeological reconstructions show it to have been a beautiful thing. Its calculated diameter of just 70 millimeters when intact would have made it practically impossible to put even the thinnest hand into it. The most likely solution, however, since it undoubtedly was worn, is that this stone bracelet originally took the form of a torque, not fully encircling the wrist, but with a section removed. The tips of the bracelet were likely cone-shaped. Such a shape of the ends of the bracelet makes it easy to put on a hand tangentially. Judging by the size of the artifact and the signs of extensive use wear on the interior surface close to the end, the bracelet sat tightly on the wrist. These signs included evidence of long contact of the interior surface with human skin, and more intimately, of remains of fat from human skin. Details that reach across the ages and forge a poignant sense of connection. Indeed, it dilates the imagination to contemplate the identity of the person this bracelet was originally made for, who certainly, given the estimated diameter, must have had slim and graceful wrists to wear it well. It's unlikely to have been the property of a child because of its rarity, artistry, and high value. As the investigators report, it brightly shimmers in broad daylight and reveals a rich play of hunter green shades in the light of a campfire. The bracelet was hardly an everyday item. Fragile and elegant, it was apparently worn on very special occasions. Given the utmost rarity of the material and the thorough finish, the bracelet was a prestigious ornament, attesting to its owner's high status. All in all, it seems a fair speculation that the slim-wristed person who owned this bracelet so many millennia ago was a woman. If so, whoever she was, whatever position of status she may have occupied, we can also guess that she had quite an eye for beauty and a whimsical sense of style. A nice additional detail of the bracelet is that for a long while, the drilled hole held a leather strap from which was suspended a pendant. Though neither the pendant nor the strap has survived, their presence left unmistakable polish marks around the hole. The polished area is limited, suggesting that the pendant was rather heavy and caused a strictly set amplitude of oscillation of the strap. The outlines of the polished area suggest the up and down sides of the bracelet and allow us to assume that the bracelet was worn on the right arm. Again, there is that sense of contact, of intimacy, as though we're separated by no more than a hair's breadth from this ancient human. It must be admitted, however, that even here we're speculating. We might not be dealing with a single individual at all. The bracelet might instead have been a treasured heirloom, passed down from mother to daughter across many generations. Whatever the truth is, it was eventually broken, not once, but twice. On the first occasion, the break was evidently accidental, and it must still have been cherished because it was carefully repaired, literally put back together again, with some effective but as yet unidentified form of glue. The second occasion was very different. It appears that the bracelet was deliberately smashed. We can only guess at the motive, by a blow against a hard surface. The Eye of the Needle. The lower part of level 11 dates back, as we've seen, to around 50,000 years ago, but the bracelet was found in the upper part, officially designated level 11.1, and provisionally dated to the upper Paleolithic about 30,000 years ago, making it, because of its Neolithic characteristics, roughly 20,000 years ahead of its time. The listener will understand, therefore, why it was one of the frustrations of our trip to Siberia in September 2017 that I was not able to see nor Santha to photograph this enigmatic, intriguing, and profoundly out-of-place bracelet. Under normal circumstances, it is kept at the Museum of the Peoples of Siberia in Novosibirsk, but as luck would have it, during our short visit there, it was out of town. Indeed, not only out of town, but out of Siberia, out of Russia, and in fact in Paris, where it had been on show in an exhibition. When I said we'd travel there to see it, Irina Selnikova told us that it was no longer on public view and was under investigation by an international team of archaeologists. Gone with it was a second anomalous object, an exquisite bone needle, 7.6 centimeters in length, with a near microscopic eye, less than 1 millimeter in diameter, drilled out at the head. Slightly curved, like a modern surgical suture needle, it was excavated from the lower part of level 11, level 11.2, of the central chamber in the summer season of 2016. No detailed analysis had been published before my visit to Novosibirsk in September 2017, but there was some coverage in the Russian media when the discovery was announced. It is the most unique find of this season, which can even be called sensational, commented Professor Michael Shunkov, co-author of the report on the bracelet and director of the Institute of Archaeology and Ethnography at the Russian Academy of Sciences. His colleague, Dr. Maxim Kozlikin, added, "It's the longest needle found in Denisova Cave. We have found needles before, but in younger archaeological layers." He was referring specifically to the upper part of level 11, where the bracelet was found, and where indeed other smaller bone needles had also been excavated some years before. They too have fine drilled-out eyes of the type more usually seen in Neolithic than in Paleolithic deposits, and provided grounds for skeptics to suggest that the Denisovan dates might have to be revised. The idea was floated that both the bracelet and the small needles must in fact be of Neolithic provenance, but had somehow migrated downward through the deposits to end up in level 11.1, a stratum, from the skeptical point of view, in which they were obviously too advanced and untypical to belong. What put an end to such speculation was the discovery of the longer, even finer, and more technically perfect needle in 2016, and its location, not in the upper, younger part of level 11, near its contact with level 10, but instead in the much older, lower part, near its contact with level 12. As we've seen, this lower part of level 11 has been dated by accelerated mass spectrometry to around 50,000 years before the present, although it may be more ancient, given that 50,000 years is the limit of radiocarbon dating. By the second half of 2016, therefore, far from proving younger, as some had expected, the mysterious artifacts of Denisova Cave were beginning to look like they were much, much older. This impression was confirmed in 2017 with a shocking announcement. Level 11 had been reassessed and its various internal strata re-examined and redated. The result of these new investigations was that the bracelet was no longer thought to be 30,000 years old, as had originally been supposed, but 50,000 years old. A year later, the Siberian Times published speculation that it might be even older, perhaps as much as 65,000 to 70,000 years old. Professor Shunkov did not welcome the speculation and pointed out that the great antiquity of the bracelet was already a matter of global significance with immense implications for the way archaeologists look at the past. He wasn't about to commit to an older date before all the relevant experts had reached consensus. "Until then, I will refrain from saying anything," he explained, adding that some data was ambiguous and required clarification. "If or when we agree, we will have to prepare a publication first." I could understand his caution. It was the same sort of caution, for pretty much the same reasons, as Tom Demaray had felt for so long before presenting his controversial evidence and conclusions about the Cerruti Mastodon site in the pages of Nature. With discoveries like these that have the potential to disrupt years of comfortable scientific consensus, it pays to take care and to prepare the ground before you go public. Persistent rumors filter out of paradigm-busting new discoveries concerning the Denisovans and multiple big headlines coming up. Meanwhile, that beautiful and haunting cave in the Siberian Altai was still, as I write these words in 2018, the only place on Earth where physical remains of Denisovans have been confirmed. Those so far recovered are few in number, but such are the wonders of genetic science that the fingertip we spoke of earlier, some teeth, some additional bone fragments, and even some dust from the cave floor allow us to be quite sure the Denisovans were in occupation here at least as early as 170,000 years ago, and that they came back 110,000 years ago and again around 50,000 years ago. Just like the Neanderthals who overlapped with our ancestors and interbred with them, so too the Denisovans overlapped the Neanderthals and interbred with them, while also, again like the Neanderthals, interbreeding with anatomically modern humans. Viable offspring, capable of reproduction, resulted from all these liaisons, and in August 2018, Denisova Cave obliged yet again by yielding up a bone fragment more than 50,000 years old and in sufficiently good condition for genome sequencing. It turned out to have belonged to a female, about 13 years of age, who had a Neanderthal mother and a Denisovan father. In consequence of such liaisons, It's a tricky business, tens of thousands of years later, to unravel the tangle of inheritance, with gene flow going in both directions between Neanderthals and Denisovans, Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans, and Denisovans and anatomically modern humans. Thus, where Denisovan DNA is found in human populations today, to give just a single example of the sorts of difficulties faced, researchers must be alert to the possibility that it may not have come directly from a Denisovan, but via a Neanderthal who had inherited DNA from an earlier tryst, perhaps dozens of generations back, between a Neanderthal and a Denisovan. Multiple other bewildering combinations are also possible. But using powerful computers, geneticists are able to disentangle this cat's cradle of intertwining genes and lives. What now appears to be certain is that Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, as modern humans are classified taxonomically, and Denisovans all shared and descended from a common ancestor a million years or so ago. The divergence of the Neanderthal line from the modern human line began at least 430,000 years ago, and perhaps as early as 765,000 years ago. The divergence of the Neanderthal line from the Denisovan line occurred between 381,000 and 473,000 years ago. Humans today are therefore, to a greater or lesser degree, hybrids, who have inherited genes from Neanderthals, Denisovans, and archaic Homo sapiens. Crossing the line. The modern inhabitants of the Altai are notable in that they have inherited virtually no Denisovan DNA at all, just a tiny fraction of a single percent. By contrast, the human populations with the highest percentage of Denisovan DNA today are found among geographically isolated New Guinean and Australian Aborigines, in the range of 3 to 4%. The first detailed investigation went a little higher than this in some cases, concluding, for example, that the archaic Denisovan population contributed 4 to 6% of its genetic material to the genomes of present-day Melanesians. Subsequently, varying levels of Denisovan admixture have also been identified in populations from eastern Indonesia, the Philippines, near and remote Oceania, and the Americas. At first, this widespread heritage seems strange in view of the location of Denisova Cave itself, deep in the Altai Mountains of southern Siberia, thousands of miles from New Guinea and Australia, and even farther from the Americas. But tens of millennia have passed since the Denisovans occupied the cave, occasionally interbreeding with Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans, and passing on their genes through all kinds of convoluted liaisons and migrations. We don't even know, on the most recent evidence it seems unlikely, that the cave was in any way central to the Denisovan range. It could equally well have been some peripheral outpost, and indeed a number of scientists, notable among them Alan Cooper of the University of Adelaide and Christopher Stringer of London's Natural History Museum, have made a case that the ancient Denisovan homeland was not in Siberia, or indeed in Asia at all, but instead lay east of Wallace's line. A deep oceanic trough, notorious for its fast-flowing currents, Wallace's line divides Asia to its west from Australia to its east. It is rightly recognized as one of the world's biggest biogeographic disjunctions. And even during the lowered sea levels of the last ice age, it would always have confronted migrants seeking to travel in either direction with a challenging maritime crossing. Any who undertook it must not only have been intrepid explorers of unknown realms and lands, but must also have possessed sufficient sailing and navigational skills to cross 30 kilometers of deep and sometimes turbulent open water between Bali and Lombok, and in the case of those who reached Papua New Guinea and Australia, to cross again the wider Gulf of the Timor Straits, a formidable barrier of 90 kilometers of open water, even at times of lowest sea level. Coupled with the presence, very far to the west in Siberia, of Denisovan artifacts, as well as Denisovan physical remains yielding a fully sequenced genome, the prominent Denisovan genetic signal among Australian Aborigines and Melanesians cannot be explained without invoking these open water crossings. In remote antiquity, somebody was certainly undertaking them, and in the process, spreading Denisovan genes. What we don't know yet is whether this gene flow was the result of direct interbreeding with the Denisovans themselves, or with some perhaps as yet unidentified people whose own heritage included a significant admixture of Denisovan genes. We also don't know, and can only guess, at the location of the lost homeland of the Denisovans. Was it east of Wallace's line, as Cooper and Stringer have argued? Or might it not just as well have been west of the line, on the plains and savannas of the exposed Sunda Shelf, during the lowered sea levels of the last ice age, when the Malaysian Peninsula and the islands of Sumatra, Java, and Borneo all formed one continuous landmass? Wherever it was, we know that 90 kilometers of open water was no barrier to these people. So why not farther? Why should they not even have crossed to the other side of the Pacific Ocean, making landfall in the Americas?